The Work Lab podcast from Microsoft answers the questions that keep business leaders up at night. Like, how can I reinvent processes for the AI era, from customer service to sales to HR? How can I prepare for AI to fundamentally transform jobs, companies, industries, and the whole economy? Don't panic. Tune in. Each episode of Work Lab brings you the top experts, hard data, and actionable insights to help you future-proof your organization. Check out Work Lab, that's W-O-R-K-L-A-B, no spaces, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is simply the best way there is to keep on top of all the important news coming out of China with our indispensable daily newsletter, website, and growing range of podcasts and videos. It's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, coming to you today from Seneca's temporary studio in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. I am delighted to welcome Bohan Phoenix, a super talented rapper who straddles the worlds of Chinese and American hip-hop and has accomplished the rare feat of making a name for himself in both of these markets, often rapping bilingually and often about, you know, being of two worlds and of neither, something that I have some experience with myself. So back before the world changed, Bohan was flying back and forth between New York and the city that he's adopted as his kind of Chinese home, a city that happens also to be the rap capital of China, Chengdu in Sichuan province. So, Bohan, man, it's an honor. Welcome to Seneca.
Thank you so much for having me, Kaiser.
Yeah, it's great, man.
Hell yeah.
I'm also joined by Allison Toy, who, as it happens, is Bohan's manager, but also definitely an artist in her own right, somebody who has deep experience in the music business with a focus on artists who cross the Pacific in one direction or another. She also lived in China for a good stint until 2018. Allison joins us from San Francisco. Allison, great to have you on.
Thanks for having me, man.
All right. So Bohan, Allison, first of all,
yo,
tell me how it is in lockdown. I mean, you're a rap artist. You know, your livelihood obviously comes from gigging, Allison, you too. Are you able to, refocus now on other facets of the work, just like writing new material? And do you have what you need at home? I mean, obviously, I see that you're pretty geared up. That's good because we're able to do this recording. What's going on?
Allison, you want to take this?
I mean, yeah, I think we should really hear from both of us on this one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll say for me, I have been DJing for many years. Of recent, it's been mostly sort of a side thing for me. So my day job, I guess, right now is working over at Twitch doing artist relations. And so that's been a big focus for me. And funny enough, it's one of the businesses where lockdown actually kind of helps us a little bit. So, you know, I'm super grateful for that and everything. But yeah, I'd say it's been a really interesting time for a lot of people. A lot of people close to me, mostly creatives and people in music, to kind of be collectively looking inward and spending a little more time on ourselves. And I think there's a lot of challenges that come along with that, but there's also a lot to be gained from it too. So taking it day by day and feeling pretty blessed about it all, to be honest.
Hey, what about you, Bohan?
Yeah, man. I mean, pretty much the same thing. I would have been on the road. Probably would be in Asia right now. I had a festival in Singapore in April, but yeah, I'm just taking this time to really focus on things that I haven't focused on in a long time or ever, like, you know, besides music, obviously, doing a lot of cooking, finding myself cooking, you know. And honestly, for I'm 27 years old, like, you know, I'm put together fan chi chao dan for the first time, you know. So, you know, stuff like that, really, you know, reading a lot of books that I've been wanting to get to. As much as I love performing, I love being on the road, but I'm not really like a going out to club or bars type of guy, like when I'm half my free time. So honestly, I'm a homebody, so it hasn't been too crazy of a change, but you definitely feel the atmosphere, you know?
Yeah. So is there going to be a new genre coming out called rapsipes, like recipes in hip-hop?
Hey, there you go. I didn't think about that, but hey, Allison had a name called Snacky Chin back in the day. So.
I was made for these rapsipes, guys.
Oh, man. Yeah, that's definitely going to be a new thing.
But yeah,
Yeah. So I'm curious, man, where does the name Bohan come from? Bohan Phoenix.
So my Chinese name is Leng Bohan.
Oh, it's your name. Bohan. Okay.
Yeah. So Bohan is 博士的博，寒阳的寒。
Okay.
冷天的冷，姓冷。
Oh, man. You want cold, ice cold motherfucker then.
Yeah, it's a cool name, man.
It is, man.
But Bohan, you know, my mom wanted me to have knowledge in the 博士 manner and 寒阳 in the, you know, have good, mannerisms.
Okay.
But yeah, and a Phoenix, so I was actually, I mean, before Bohan Phoenix, I was going by Finale with a PH.
Uh-huh.
And I just thought, you know, you save the best thing for last, and the finale's last, so I'm the finale. You can really get to the, you know, elementary thinking there. But, you know, when I was like 22, I had spent exactly half my life in China, half my life in the States. And I just thought, you know, my life in Yichang, Hubei, compared to Boston and New York was so different. And my life before music and after music was so different. Just, you know, just from like even confidence level. And that, you know, Phoenix, it felt like a rebirth after college was done. And I was really doing the music the full time. You know, I changed my name to Bohan Phoenix. I felt like it represented who I was at the time.
Yeah. So definitely rebirth back from the ashes. There's a story you've told about, you know, when you had first come to the, I say you were in still in grade school, but when you were in high school in America, you used to walk around the outside of the school just to avoid going through the hallway and actually talking to people. So how did you transform from this kind of, you know, introverted immigrant kid to this global hip hop star, man? I mean, that's just not an easy.
Well, not really a hip hop star yet, but you know, we're getting there. But okay. I appreciate that. Appreciate the love. But I think there's many different factors. So my father wasn't ever in my life. So my stepfather, he's this big Swedish American dude. He really took, you know, he really was responsible for introducing me to sports, team sports, to make friends. He brought me to Chinatown to do martial arts in case I wanted a community that looked like me, that talked like me, that I could be comfortable at. And he just brought me around to getting clothes at Marshall's, getting food, and like, it wasn't that like it was foreign. It was more like I didn't have the confidence in myself, you know. And he kind of like gave me the many different ways to meet people, but yeah, like you said, like I was pretty uncomfortable about walking through a hallway because I thought people would be looking at me and judge me. And so I would like be in a classroom eating lunch by myself, or walk, you know, from one end of the school out and back in the other. But once I, you know, I think one of the big breakthroughs for me, self-confidence wise, was getting on stage with my gospel choir and then rapping with my gospel choir behind me to people that I was afraid of walking in front of, you know, during the daytime. So that was really like a thing in junior year that just, you know, blew my shit away. You know, I was like, wow, like, you know, I could like go up to somebody and like kind of talk to them in a way I never could before. And I think that was the transition point right there.
Allison, you came from a completely different world than Bohan. You were born here in the States, and not the same exact kinds of hurdles to assimilation. Also, just, you know, being female versus being male and being Asian are totally different experiences. And you grew up on the peninsula, yeah? Like in San Mateo?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Bay Area.
But obviously something about artists who straddle these two worlds has drawn you. You've always been interested in them. I mean, you've worked with you know, a number of artists, you know, as a manager, but also you yourself were drawn to China. Tell me a little bit about that. What was, you know, your analogous experience like? You know, how was your relationship to your Chineseness growing up?
You know, it was really interesting. I think I'm really fortunate in that growing up in the Bay Area, there was always a big Chinese American population, a big Asian population. But I oftentimes actually found myself a bit on the outside of that. Both of my parents were born and raised in the Bay Area. And on my mom's side, her father was also born in California. So I'm like second, third generation. And in many ways, right, as I was growing up, most of my peers around me were born of immigrants. They were first generation folks. And, you know, I was always kind of curious and in a way jealous of the understanding that they had of their cultures and whatnot. You know, and so I think in a way, my desire to sort of learn about my own heritage was one of the many things that kind of fueled me to get into music. I mean, I think it wasn't really until working with Bohan that I even really considered China as a destination for music, to be honest.
Oh, really?
Okay. But I had always, yeah, I had always cared deeply about Asian American music and Chinese American experiences and whatnot. But in terms of connection to the mainland and whatnot, pretty much all of my family's in California. So I had really very little until my adult life.
But Bohan, I'm curious, when you were growing up and going to school, were most of your friends black or white, Asian, Latino?
So pretty much a mix of everything.
Oh, good.
And to be honest, a lot of Asian kids, Chinese kids, they didn't really want to be friends with me because I was a little too weird for them. And the people I wanted to hang out with, they didn't really understand, you know? I jumped right into a Swedish American family at, you know, Christmas and Thanksgiving, you know, like, so like, it was all good for me, like who I was hanging out with, you know. I had to like the person, and you know, it's nice that they liked me, you know, and that was kind of it, you know.
And I've heard you cite influences before, and one of them is, of course, Eminem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what was his influence on you? I mean, was he like, I mean, I've heard you talk about 8 Mile as like a major turning point for you.
Yeah, so 8 Mile actually, you know, happened when I was watching TV and watching cartoons as a way to learn English when I first got to the States.
Oh, wow.
And my mom had, you know, other friends who had came from China before in the same situation with the kids come in, and they found that helpful. And so 8 Mile, when I was watching that, my English wasn't good enough to even comprehend the movie itself, you know, all the dialogue. But the story itself of this, like, white guy doing something that's clearly predominantly black in a black world, but, like, is able to find confidence in it and is able to, you know, find, you know, friendship and all that, you know, in this really world that doesn't really belong to him. So I really related to that, you know, and I thought, you know, just from somebody who was like, you know, 13 years old, 14 years old, coming from China, I just thought this was cool. You know, like what he was doing was cool. But really, that didn't come until I was inspired by his story. And then I went and just dug up like pretty much everything there is to find on Eminem, you know.
You were like 16, 17, you said, when you were, it's junior year when you got in front of a crowd for the first time and actually rapped.
Yeah, like 16.
Wow.
16.
Wow. What was that like? I mean, it must have been hard. I mean, I remember how hard.
I do not even remember. Because when I was doing that, there was no actual thought of like, oh, I'm going to go to New York after this and like make this a thing. You know, like that was almost like a way. That was at that time, that was purely just something that I think I was doing for self-confidence, but I was also really curious in the music, you know.
You were in Boston, right?
Yeah, I was in Boston, but I don't think I was able to really look at it like experience as critically as I am able to like remember it, you know, if that makes sense.
What was the reaction of your friends? I mean, how did
I think everybody was nice.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if they thought I was whack, they probably didn't say it to my face, you know. But I mean, my choir director, the reason I was even in the choir, because like I wanted to be closer to music once I got over my just pure obsession with Eminem. And I was like, how do I get closer to music, you know? And so I joined his choir. But the choir director, he's like, well, you're not really good of a singer, you know? But I heard you like to rap. If you're willing to rap on stage and write some verses about God, about love, you know, then I'll let you join the choir. You can be in a tenor section, you know, and kind of just blend in. You know, it's like, yeah, that's, you know, that's cool with me.
Was that a private school or public school?
Public school.
Really?
Public school.
The guy was telling you to rap about God in a public school.
Yeah, I mean,
I got a problem with that, but anyway.
'90s was different.
I mean, it was a gospel choir. Yeah, it was a gospel choir, so the content had to fit.
You know, Alice, I want to ask you about how you first encountered Bohan. I mean, before you went to China, you didn't speak Mandarin. You know, there's not a lot of hip-hop in the Toisan dialect, which I guess you probably heard a bit of growing up. What was it that grabbed you about Bohan? I mean, you know, there's clearly something going on already at that time with Chinese hip-hop. He's obviously talented, but what was it that you saw that separated him from other guys?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it really started with the music. You know, Bohan and I were not friends before we started working together. It really, for me, like at the time that we kind of first touched base, I think it was around 2015, I had been working in the music industry for several years at that point, and you know, it had become exceedingly obvious to me that there were no people that looked like me on stage or really off stage either, right? And so, you know, I had kind of made it a point to try and find other people, other Asian Americans in the business, and, you know, as artists and behind the scenes and whatnot. And they were really few and far between. I always wanted to support an Asian artist, and I hadn't really found anybody that I found super impressive until I came across Bohan's work. And I think
had you heard like MC Jing or anything before that?
Yeah, I had. I had. And, you know, I think I had some interest in it, but I think what was really cool about Bohan for me was that at the time, which was 2015, long before diversity and inclusion became like such a part of the conversation that it is now, he was talking about things like identity, and the beats that he was rapping on and stuff had like Asian instrumentation in it and stuff like that. And it was just nothing. I didn't really hear anything else quite like that that had been done well, tastefully, and in an interesting kind of genre bending way. And I was just like, you know, Asian or not, the musical quality of this stuff is incredible.
Yeah.
And so the way that we first made contact was I literally realized that we had a few mutual friends, but I reached out on Twitter. I DM'd him. It was.
Yeah, I was like, who's this?
Like, I was that excited. I couldn't even wait for Madison to put us in touch. I had to reach out to you directly, like, the second I heard your music. And I was just like, I don't know who you are or what you're about, but I fuck with this. And, like, I want to fuck with you. And then we became friends. And the rest is history in a weird way.
Fuck yeah. Hell yeah.
Nice, nice. Bohan breaks a lot of stereotypes. You have this song YMF, you know, which stands for Young Motherfucker. And you talk about how Asians should be doing math instead of rapping, you know, that stereotype and stuff like that. Right. There's a line in that song that says something like, "What, are you trying to be black, motherfucker?"
Is this you're trying to rap, motherfucker? Oh, so you're trying to be black, motherfucker?
Right, right.
Don't make me laugh. Stick to math, motherfucker.
Right, that's
what I whoop that ass, motherfucker.
Yeah. Is this something that you heard from black people, actually, from other Asians, from white people? I mean, from all of them? Or is that kind of an imagined?
So definitely in person, actually mostly from Asian people.
Yeah, that's right. What
but online, there's, you know, you see all sorts of comments being made from different people. But it's honestly almost like it's almost not really a touch on a direct experience, but more of like a like this talking about just the infrastructure for the playing field that we have right now.
Yeah.
That more of a comment on that than like a personal experience. Because honestly, my personal experience, and I've always talked about this, is one that people have always showed love. You know, like everywhere I've been, like whether people, you know, they liked it or they didn't like it, it's always been love, you know? Like,
yeah, man, you're breaking my heart. I'm thinking about you coming from this broken home. Turns out you have this totally great, loving Swedish-American stepdad who takes, you know, experience all this shit. No, actually, everyone's been totally supportive. Yeah. No, that's awesome.
Yeah.
It's good to hear.
I mean, the thing is like, my stepfather and, you know, my mom never really, you know, told me not to do it because she felt guilty for not being there for the first half of my life. So she kind of just let me do my thing, you know, and she thought it would be a phase and they'll be over. But, you know, I started showing some results before it was over. So,
wow.
But my stepfather he's old. He was born in 1950, you know, like from Dedham, like an Irish town. He just thought like, if I'm going to be able to get into NYU, why am I wasting my time doing something else that's not certain at all, you know? He's like, just put in the hard work, get a degree, you know, and do the best you can.
What did you end up getting a degree in?
Communications.
All right.
Okay. I started off in economics because I was like, oh man, I'm going to take out so much loans, I might as well get something that, I don't know. Like,
go work on Wall Street.
I thought I was going to use it or something. You know?
Something that I could recoup this on.
Yeah, exactly. But then, like, my junior year, I couldn't pass a single... I mean, like, it was by my junior year, I was still trying to pass the freshman math classes. So, at that time, I actually wrote a letter to the president of NYU, John Sexton, because he had a thing. His whole agenda was, I'm the student's president, email me anytime. So I emailed him. I was like, look, I'm not going to be able to graduate on time. Can I change into communications? And he like had me over to his office, had some cheese and crackers on the table. He's like, yeah, you all set, you know? And the reason I chose communications, I was a J. Cole fan at the time, big J. Cole fan. And I looked up what he studied. He went to St. John's for communications. I was like, oh, okay, cool. If it's good, it's good enough for him, it's good enough for
me. I have no idea what's actually studied in communications, but
exactly. Me neither.
So Allison, you know, hip hop culture, especially when it comes to male rappers, has certain expectations of masculinity, of hyper masculinity, even maybe toxic even. There's a lot of defiance and the braggadocio about the physicality, sexual prowess, even a lot of, I mean, straight up misogyny, a lot of critics would say. I think things have definitely changed, but I think we have to recognize that there's certain stereotypes of Asian males that run pretty counter to those expectations. So how do you feel when you hear some of the sort of more overtly sexual themes in Bohan's lyrics? I mean, that is there a disconnect there, or is it just sort of performative, or do you think this, like,
I mean, not really for me. And I think part of that is because I know dude, and I'm like, yo, this is real, actually.
Okay.
I mean, aside from that, I think a lot of it is really like the performative aspect of hip hop. I mean, I feel like so much of what rappers do is designed for its pimp out ability, for lack of a better word, that, you know, in a way,
that's a fine word.
in a way, I think for me, like, I've maybe just become not immune to it, but a little deaf to it. I think I've always kind of grown up with more male friends than female friends. When I first moved to New York, the way I survived was DJing for a living. At the time, there were no female DJs, like, let alone Asian female DJs. And so I think, like, my tolerance for men's locker room talk is at a much higher threshold than your average girl. So
wait, Kaiser, I need to know which specific lines you're thinking about.
I don't know. I mean, references to women's genitals and your tongue, for example. You know, that kind of.
Have I said that?
Yeah. Respectfully.
I wonder if I was creative about it.
All right. No, you were fine. No, I might have to bleep that part anyway. So, I mean, has the image of Asian rappers in the U.S. changed since you guys started, you know, doing this? Has it changed since you started paying attention to it?
I mean, I totally see, like, you know, all the rappers that's got the dreads, that's got the colorful hair, that's got the, you know, all the chains, you know, just the typical trap star, rich the kid look, you know, and that works out for a lot of them. But for me, I've always just been too self-conscious to do anything that was like outside music, you know, like the bandana thing was I don't even know why I started wearing that and how that stuck, you know, but it just did. But other than that, you know, like, you know, I'm wearing like a white t-shirt, a black t-shirt, like, I think a lot of the times, and I see this more clear in China than here, because obviously China, all the rappers I'm dealing with are Chinese. But like a lot of the time, because the social media is so strong nowadays, people think that once they have the look down, once they have, you know, once they have the package down, you know, then they got it, you know. But they got everything down, but they just don't want to put the time down to make the music, to actually like find a sound, you know, that can, you know, outlast their outfits, you know, so to speak. So.
Yeah. Allison, you want to add something?
Yeah. You know, for me, I think I look at this from a different vantage point of having been in and around the music industry for a while. And I can definitely say that I think hip hop has really expanded in terms of like what it accepts as cool over the last few years. And I think a lot of that is just streaming and, you know, accessibility of music and the ability for different types of music to really kind of incubate and grow community around it. And so I think the definition today of like what a rapper can look and sound like is a much more flexible definition than what it was 10 years ago.
That's so true.
And, you know, I think a lot of things contribute to that, but, you know, in terms of what that means for Asian rappers is only good things, really. You know, I think it's just overall a much more open and accepting and actually curious listener than there were in the past.
Yeah, I want to move this over to China now, and you guys have done some really interesting work there. I'm curious, I mean, I had experiences definitely when in the late 80s and the 90s, just sort of you know, bringing rock music and bringing heavy metal into China, or helping to, you know, finding a scene that was still pretty underdeveloped and then being a part of that. And I got to think that there's a pretty similar experience with you guys over there. So what was it like trying to do that before it got really big and mainstream, before, you know, Rap of China was such a gigantic hit on, was it on Qihu? No, I mean on iQIYI.
Mm-hmm.
So you guys got to have some interesting stories to share about those earlier days, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if they're interesting or not, but those earlier days were definitely so much more refreshing than... I mean, those earlier days are why I moved to China in 2017. Yep. So, I mean, when I first got to New York, once I was at New York, I didn't think about leaving New York ever, you know, going back to China for hip-hop, you know, like, that was never a thing, you know? But a lot of things lined up, and a friend ended up flying us back to Beijing to work with this guy, Howie Lee.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He's like a producer from Beijing, and just, man, I heard his music. I was like, how do we get this music in front of Pharrell and Kanye? Like, you know, the stuff he was making in 2015 was so cool.
Yeah.
And so we were out there in Beijing, and I'm like, I had no idea what to expect. I have 4 of my friends from Brooklyn with me, you know, like, because we went back and I had my videographer, Tony G, with me, and we ended up shooting 2 videos in a week while we're out there and doing a show. And the night of the show, the line was so far out onto the street, and we ended up having like 400 people in this small bar called Dada, you know. Yeah. And I'm rapping on top of the DJ table because there's no stage or nothing, you know. And the show was so crazy. People were pushing and shoving. And in the middle of the show, this guy picks up a beer bottle and just breaks it over this other guy's head. And that throughout that night, there were like 3 or 4 fights because how rowdy the crowd was.
Wow.
And we, you know, like the entire night at a hotel, we couldn't sleep. I was talking, me and, you know, my friends were like, this is like unreal.
Yeah.
And so that was 2015. And then 2016, Vice China brought us back again for a tour. And we were like, you know, in my head, when we came back from the 2015, I was like, wow, I can't wait to go back out there. And then this Vice thing happens, and it was 7 cities to places that I haven't been in my, you know, and I was born in China. So those times when people came out for shows, you could tell, man, they were there for the music. There was no phones, you know, there was no like star chasing. It was like, it was music. And you could tell, when you had a hip hop show, everybody in that town that listened to hip hop, like really listened to hip hop, they was out there.
Nice.
You know, like,
nice.
And yeah, and that was so, I mean, I remember thinking, you know, when I was in New York, wow, it would be great if I was in New York when hip hop just started, you know, just to see what that's like. And I remember thinking and trying to like, wow, this is exactly what that's like, you know, like. And yeah, it was a crazy feeling. But then, you know, once the Rap of China show happened, obviously everything just changed.
How did your stuff get received there? I mean, at that point, was it still pretty strictly American style, or was there already like, you know, a lot of lyrics that were in Chinese and a lot of Chinese, you know, musical elements? And how did they react to you?
So I had some songs up on the internet already.
Mm-hmm.
And so when me and Howie had put out our stuff, then, you know, they had looked at some of that stuff. But the stuff that me and Howie were doing, they really loved. And I think, you know, without Howie, maybe that intro into China would have been slower or rougher than it was.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I think Howie, as credible as he is, and, you know, as just as amazing. Those, honestly, anybody could have rapped on those beats, and those would have been really a fire records, you know. And but I was just, you know, like, once I got those, I was just obsessed with those. And yeah, so the reaction was really good. The reaction was really good. And I think this idea of like this thing about being from New York makes you more credible than you probably right, you know, deserve right. to be, you know, like. And they were like, yeah,
hey, I'm from New York. I'm from upstate, though. It doesn't count.
Hey, you know what I'm saying? You feel what I'm saying? Like, it does give you a certain aura. It's like, oh, Bohan and Ban from New York, you know?
Nice.
Yeah, it was cool.
Do you, Allison, I'll put this one to you. Do you feel like the world of hip-hop in China and in the United States, these two worlds, are showing more signs of convergence or of divergence? Are they moving further apart stylistically or lyrically or musically, or are they coming together more?
You know, that's a really good question. And I think when I look at hip-hop in China, I think of kind of like two kind of distinctly different trends in a way, right? Uh-huh. I think there was like this sort of long history of small and underground stuff like Iron Mike battles and everything. And that has been...
Shout out to...
Yeah, exactly.
Iron Mike, yeah, for sure.
And, you know, that's been...
That guy, he's been... Yeah. It's been great. Just Dana, hey, how's it going, man?
What up, Showtime? Yeah. Showtime. You know, I think that had been sort of like a cultural undercurrent in China for a minute, but it sits like very much in opposition to this new coming of hip hop a la rap of China, right? What I can say about either of those is that I think they're both very different from how it looks in the States. Right. Like if you look at sort of hip hop and how it kind of developed in the U.S., it sort of came from the streets. It came from struggle. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this sort of underdog narrative and fight. And that is so different from arriving on the scene with McDonald's sponsorship. Right. Like, which is kind of how it went down in China. And, you know, I really just, I have a lot of trouble kind of comparing the two, especially with like the Western narrative so much being like in opposition to like the system and politics and like the predominant narrative, and how that is a really difficult message to try and even wrap your mind around in a place like China, where things like the African American experience like has absolutely no equivalent out there, right?
And yet I feel like at the same time there's more maybe authenticity than I had thought was a few years ago. I would see rap as being very much intermediated by geographies like Japan or South Korea. Like they were getting it secondhand. It was coming first to South Korea, Taiwan, or Japan, and then to the mainland, and getting, you know, watered down and really kind of made mainstream in the process. But it seems like in more recent years they're drinking more straight from the tap. Like they're really paying direct attention, because of the internet and because of so many other things, they're paying much more attention to what's actually happening, you know, in LA, in New York, in Atlanta, even, you know, and stuff like that.
Right.
So does that seem true to you?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Okay. I mean, the VPN definitely just opened up the world for people that actually wanted to look for things, you know, like it was really,
you got to do a rap about the VPN, man.
Yeah, for real. I mean, shout out VPN. I mean, like, I remember like meeting some rappers in China for the first time and just purely asked them because I was curious. I was like, how are you guys listening to stuff? And they're like, well, we're just logging VPN and going on SoundCloud and YouTube. And I was like,
That's easy enough.
You know, fair enough, you know, like easy enough. And I think that was, you know, up until the last 2-3 years, the government wasn't really that crazy on cracking down on VPNs, you know. So it was really a one click thing. Actually, Howie had somebody had asked Howie about VPN. He had a really good answer that I always tell people, pretend is my answer. But like he said, you know, it's like a smart kid and a dumb kid. Like the dumb kid, the mom put a lock on the door, he's just gonna stay in the room. But the smart kid's just gonna climb out the window, you know, like, and he's gonna do what he's gotta do, you know.
It didn't take a lot of smarts to get on a VPN back in the day. It's a little harder now, but back in the day, anyone with two brain cells can do it. You talked about African American culture there. You know, from your years of watching the Chinese music scene and living in China, Allison, has the rising popularity of hip-hop changed the way that young Chinese people see Africans and African-Americans? I mean, on the one hand, you know, I think there's definitely a case to be made that the kind of prejudice that I used to see in my early years of Beijing has definitely given way to much more tolerance. But on the other hand, you see the kind of nonsense that people write online. You know, there's so much racism still. If you look at these incidents from last month when Africans and especially people from Nigeria, I mean, they were just kicked out of these hotels and other residences ostensibly because of, you know, they hadn't, you know, the gotten tested or whatever. And I mean, you know, part of me understands that kind of fear about the disease and everything, but it seemed pretty cold. I mean, pretty awful. And there was obviously a big, you know, bit of it was just straight up racism. So What's the relationship between hip hop and the hopefully decline of racism in China?
Man, that's a tough question. I mean, I think it depends on who you talk to. Like, I definitely, as an American going to China, as a Chinese American, but really as an American, had very little hope that of racial tolerance in China, right? It just didn't seem like something that was on people's minds. And I found oftentimes that I was pleasantly surprised by a lot of the people that I met. Granted, a lot of these people being creatives, people that work in music or media, and really the type to seek out what is, you know, beyond the great firewall and whatnot, and really get into it. So it's a difficult question. I mean, Bohan and I have talked quite a lot about this and how that, especially amongst like the Chinese rap community, has changed over the years, where, you know, I remember in the beginning Bohan telling me about instances where he had to teach people not to use the N-word, and trying to explain what that meant to somebody who had no frame of reference for it was a tough battle, for sure. It's still difficult.
Yeah.
I mean, like, it's just to continue her point there. Yeah, I remember, like, you know, telling people, rappers in China, you can't say that. And they're like, why? I'm not racist. And I had to explain to them that the context of the word and where it came from, all that. And they're like, well, but I'm not racist. You know, I'll explain the whole kind of, they're like, well, but I'm not that, you know? And then really, and it made me think too. I was like, wow, are people out here held accountable for the same things that I am, you know, by being out there just totally in isolation and viewing it from the lens of the internet, you know? I had to really think about that, and I don't know the answer to that. But, you know, to kind of answer like your question, I guess, I think the younger kids are the ones that are more open to, you know, the to African Americans, you know. But for example, like my aunt, you know, she will be asking me like, "Oh, where do you live in New York? Well, is there a lot of, you know, hate and a lot of black people? Jeez, you know, is it safe?" You know, like, and because she gets that through whatever it is, the media, the news, whatever, you know, like that she gets it from. But then, so when my friends from New York went back with me, and in Chengdu, we all stayed at home. So I had two African-American friends staying in the house. And she ended up, I mean, she loved them, you know? She still asked me about Ralph and Zach to today, you know? Like, and like, I remember having a conversation with her about it. She's like, yeah, like, wow, like, black people are so nice, you know? And like, it's an unreal conversation to have, you know? Like to see that immediate change in reaction, you know, purely based on like I actually got like come in contact with the things that I don't understand, right? And now I understand, you know, like I think a lot of the things that's happening in China right now, I mean, man, I'm sure we all know like what's fundamentally like wrong or right or wrong, and them kicking people out in the middle of the night from their homes, whatever reason, is just wrong, you know. And And as a Chinese American, I've always, you know, it was harder as a younger kid, but now I have no problem saying that I do not agree with 100% what China does. Absolutely not, you know. And just like the American side of me don't agree with the American, what America does all the time. And I'm trying to wrap my head around, you know, the incidents that's happening to the Nigerians in Guangzhou. And if you look at it from, you know, what the Chinese government have always stood for, which is sovereignty, which is, you know, keeping things in China, it kind of makes sense from their perspective. But from us, our perspective, I mean, that's just brutality, you know. So it's really
crazy. That's right. That's a big can of worms. So we could talk a whole another hour about that. I want to ask you, though, about you know, actually, all of us have been involved in one way or another in creating music that is, you know, that tries to be Chinese in some way, right? We run into, we were talking about this, you know, how they don't understand the sort of socioeconomic backgrounds of the kind of people who created that kind of music originally in its original context. Most of the rap guys you were friends with probably couldn't even explain the kind of the genesis of that genre of music, where it fits into the whole history of popular music in the West. We're also trying to, you know, to make it Chinese in some way, which is tough. I mean, you said, I read an interview where you, I'm going to quote you, you said, "I'm always looking for ways to add fun Chinese elements to make sure my music is not just a New York beat with Chinese rhymes." But at the same time, you don't want to overdose and make it too tacky. I have said like practically the same thing. I mean, I don't want it to be f-ing orientalist, right? I don't want it to be just like, I mean, and I know what that is when I see it, but I don't know how to explain how you know tacky from not tacky, what's authentic. Do you have some kind of a rule of thumb, or for you, is it just a gut?
Man, to be honest, I don't even believe in that anymore. I have moved on from that, you know, from what I was trying to do then. But
you don't know Chinesey stuff at all then?
Well, no, not no Chinesey stuff at all. Like if it happens to be, if it's natural, if it's like, you know, we're in a room with a bunch of artists and then like somebody happens to have, you know, like it has to be natural.
But
like,
nobody's going to have an Arhu in their back pocket or whatever.
I mean, that's not a thing. You'd be surprised. I'll pop in the studio sometimes with my homies and there's like somebody with an Arhu. There's somebody with a not even kidding. Like, you know, like they're out here. They're out here. But you know, the point is like when I was talking about that, I was at a phase where, you know, I was trying to, I thought like adding a little bit of Asian stuff was my sound, you know, and I was kind of running with that. And then until a point where I realized no matter, you know, if I'm able to make it natural, cool. But if I'm doing this intentionally on every song, like I got to rhyme in Chinese and English on every song, I'm just like making,
it's a gimmick. Right.
I'm like exoticizing myself. Yeah. I'm exoticizing myself for the sake of, hey, notice me, you know? And so I went from there to kind of like,
you just wanted, you know, to kick ass on its own right.
I kind of just want to.
No, I totally get that. I mean, I've been through the same whole process.
You know? Yeah, you just want to make the best music that you can make. You know, like you want the music to just do its work. You know,
Allison, how do you feel about this? I mean, do you have some sort of rule of thumb when you're evaluating an artist? I mean, because I've definitely heard bands like in China where it just seems so shoehorned on, or you know, just like appended. It's just like, you know, you sort of, you're wearing this, you know, dumb Chinese hat on top of a, but at the same, I've also heard acts where it's just completely organic and they just get it right. And part of me still wants Chinese music to be recognizably Chinese. You know, I don't, it's just another freaking.
Well, then you can't do hip hop.
Yeah, no.
Sorry to cut in. you can't do hip hop and want it to be Chinese. Because hip hop is black music. You know, like no matter if you can rap it in Chinese, you can have the drums be Chinese drums. You can look as Chinese you look. It's still a black, you know. Yeah, Kwai Bar. Yeah, you know, even if you take it in. But yeah.
Yeah, man. I mean, that's a tough question. I think for me, like, it's hard to put a finger on exactly what, you know, is that fine line between cheesy or not cheesy or too much or not enough, right? Man.
Yeah.
You're asking the tough ones today, Sorry. Kaiser.
Oh, that's an easy one.
But like, I'm sure it's whatever sounds right though. You know what I mean? Like, it's.
Yeah. I think for me, it's an authenticity thing, really. Like, you know, And this is no shots to K-pop because I know that there's so many fans who love it. But the thing that like I can't get past with K-pop is how manufactured it feels. Right. Like the music is just the Frankensteining of already popular sounds and ways of making music together in this sort of like neatly packaged formulaic way that just kind of freaks me out. And you know, it's listen, clearly I am maybe not even the majority in my thinking here because so many people love it, but for me it just feels fake and kind of vapid, right? And I think that's like a big thing for me in evaluating this, you know, Chineseness. Like, does it feel like a gimmick?
Right.
Are you being sincere? Have you done your homework? And like, is this Arhu here because it's the first Chinese instrument you ever heard of, or because like you actually have a connection to that sound or something? And it's hard to delineate that, you know, off the bat. But I think look and listen close enough, and it's hard to fake the funk, man.
And I'll tell you, Kaiser, like I've done a song, I've put out songs in the past where I've put Asian instrument parts in there and then it's out and I'm like, fuck, why did I just do another one of these? You know, like I immediately I'm like, fuck, you know, like.
Yeah, I know.
So, yeah.
I think we think about it in a weird way in the States too, especially with regards to how much like the Asian American narrative in entertainment has changed in the last 3 years.
Right.
Right. Like 2015, having anything remotely Asian sounding melding with hip hop was pretty few and far between. And then, you know, I think it was probably around like 2016 or so that talking about identity and where you come from started to like actually feel cool instead of like being something that, you know, people were like, oh, Asian rappers just complaining about not being represented. Right. And I think it became almost perplexingly harder to talk about identity in that world because it started to feel gimmicky or played out. And as true and as real as it was to a lot of the artists that were talking about it, it just felt, it started feeling like a parody product.
Wow.
I don't know.
That's a, yeah, it's a trap. I mean, it's a very difficult, yeah, conundrum to be in. I want to ask you about the city of Chengdu. And your first trip when you were in Beijing in 2015, I don't think you got out there, right?
No, I didn't go out to Chengdu in 2015. But I've been going back to Chengdu a lot just because family's there anyway. So before that, I was going back to Chengdu every year for, you know. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Oh, wow. So you actually have quite a bit of attachment to the city.
Yeah. I mean, we were in Hubei, but in 2004, a year after I left, 2005, 2 years after I left, my grandfather went to Chengdu.
Oh, I love that city. But I got to ask, why do you think it emerged as such a center for rap in China? I mean, Beijing became like the metal and rock capital of China. You know, maybe Shanghai more for jazz. Is there something about the personality of the city, do you think? Or are there some other factors? Why are so many of the best known rap acts all associated with Chengdu?
Yeah, I think Chengdu has a relaxed way about it. I guess that's the best way to put it. I guess in Shanghai and Beijing, you're competing with, I mean, Shanghai and Beijing, you're putting a lot of money up, first of all, just for rent, just for living, you know, and then rent aside, you know, food and all that, you know, getting around. I mean, so I think Chengdu has a relaxed way about it in that sense, and is able to give the artists a freedom where they can do a couple shows a month and pay their rent and then just work on music, you know, and that's able to, I guess, give the artists more time than the other cities where they have to actually worry about how to survive, you know, beyond just the music. So I think that's part of the reason why. And honestly, another reason that's pretty clear to me too is just the way the Chengdu dialect sounds. It sounds so amazing on, you know, like to me personally.
Yeah, I hear that a lot. I mean, you know, I hear that from a lot of people.
Yeah.
What do you think it is about Chengdu Hua or Sichuan Hua that makes it better suited than Mandarin for rap?
Well, the Mandarin tones, the 一二三四, the Mandarin tones is a little too clean, too polished for something that needs to be a little swagged out.
I see.
And the Chengdu dialect just has that kind of more country tone almost, you know, but in like a gray way, you know, and it cuts sharp. Chengdu dialect almost sounds like Japanese a little bit with the tones, you know, like it's very, 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 it's very aggressive.
Did you know it growing up? I mean, because your grandfather?
No, not at all.
Did you, have you learned it since? I mean, can you listen to it?
A little bit. I can understand. Okay, you can understand. Like, if I had to say it, I mean, I'm just going to embarrass myself.
You know? I can't understand it.
Yeah, I mean, not at first, but I mean, being in there a couple of years and definitely helped.
You've said before your favorite track of yours is 3 Days in Chengdu.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I mean, yeah. I love that track too. Hey, let's give that one a listen right now.
Jackery Beats. La la. Y'all ain't know. It's love, love, baby. Oh yeah. Oh yeah, you got me feeling real good up in this bitch. Fresh off the plane from motherland. It's your boy. I got the heat for the winner. I make it snow
in the summer. My mama told me remember. What? She told me Bohan remember. Remember. Money don't make you the winner. Nah. Money don't make you the man. Nah. Money don't make you, that's why you made money and then you go do what you
nice.
Can.
Nice. I'm actually resampling the middle part of the long section for a new song.
Oh, cool. Okay, but, cool.
Yeah.
Hey, so speaking of Chengdu, you know, you've done stuff with Higher Brothers and with Vava. Mm-hmm. Hey, I actually heard that you were like instrumental in getting those guys picked up by 88 Rising. Is that right?
Yeah, me and Allison both. Oh, wow. So okay. I was on tour in China 2016. And at that time, I've been working with a rap cypher company in the States. And I was trying to get some money from them by saying, when I'm on tour in China, I'll shoot some rap cyphers of local rappers. And then you guys can put that together and you put me as the host and, you know, you pay me some for shooting the videos. So when I got to Chengdu, I was like, okay, like I was asking Howie. Howie's like, yeah, there's a group called Chengdu Rap House. So I hit up Chengdu Rap House, the Weibo account. I don't know who answered, but they're like, oh yeah, we're not available, but Higher Brothers are. I was like, who's Higher Brothers? You know, like, and so lo and behold, we got Saipi, we got Masue, we got Nono coming through, and Mello at that time, this is before they blew up, so Mello was actually working a job at a zoo. yeah, I think his parents, I think their parents are up there somewhere, and they hooked him up with a nice job. So this one of their songs beginning that was called Tai Wei Tai Wei Tai Wei Tai Wei Tai Wei. They're missing this dude, you know, the whole time. So that was how I met them on tour. And then Allison was transitioning between Fader and 88. And 88, you know, they didn't have nobody that know nothing about China. Yeah. And Allison was able to, you know, bring Higher Brother on board.
My discovery of Higher Brothers was so random, though, because it actually happened independently of Bohan, but through the same connection, which was Howie Lee at the time had been talking to my friend Nelson, who was working at Boiler Room in New York. Mm. And Howie had made, a mix for Boiler Room, and Nelson sent it to me before it got released. And he was like, hey, what do you think of this? Like, I know you've been kind of interested in Chinese music. And I listened to the mix and there was a Higher Brothers track in there. And I was like, this is crazy. This is fire.
Oh, do you remember what it was?
I don't remember what it was.
I wonder if it's 7-Eleven.
No, older than that. It was older than that. I was still at Fader at the time. And I was like, I reached out to Howie and I was like, holy shit, like, who are these guys? Like, I need to know. And he was like, oh, these guys, Higher Brothers. And then by the time I got over to 88, somehow Bohan and I put two and two together and realized that he had met these cats last time he went to China. And so, I put one of their music videos for Black Cab in front of the colleagues that I had over there. And this was at the beginning of 88. I think I was like the fourth employee, fifth employee, something like that. And they loved it. And Bohan really helped us reach out to them. At the time, I had next to no Chinese language experience. Nobody else on the team did. We had to tell the CEO.
That was fun.
Yeah.
That was fun.
We had to like tell the CEO what VPN was and make him aware of the fact that like YouTube was blocked in China. Like it was.
He goes, wait, how are we supposed to put music up if YouTube's blocked? I was like, oh my God.
Little did you know. Yeah, it's a universal phenomenon, but you talk to people, you know, like in Chengdu, who are really into the rap scene. I mean, I go there once in a while. I was there last October, and I was talking to people.
Oh, nice.
And they get pretty exasperated when you even mention anyone who's been successful. Like, you talk about Higher Brothers, and they roll their eyes and say, oh, you know, that was like 2 years ago. You know, we all – what are people listening to now? I mean, it was like, oh, no, Shitty, he's still totally cool. And Mello, they liked, actually.
Yeah, I mean, so the difference is I can't see the fans before Rap of China as clear as I was able to before Rap of China. Right. I feel like a lot of the fans even just gave up on the rap scene, you know, like just stopped going out of concerts altogether, you know. And I think they just don't want to be around they don't want to be around the memes, you know. Uh-huh. I think the Rap of China artists have really taken over in terms of the general.
You want to say ruined
listeners?
It.
Hey, you know, okay. It made it better for a lot of people. Yeah, ruined it for me, okay. You know. Yeah. But you know, like I think, yeah, they have taken over the interest of the mainstream. But the Higher Brother fans, man, Higher Brothers are the only ones that are selling out more tickets in China. than the people that are on the show, and they didn't go on the show, you know, like, so their fans are there, you know, but a lot of people are just over how big they've been and how many shows they do and how high their ticket price are, you know, like,
it seems like, I mean, I haven't listened to everything that you've put out, but I've listened to an awful lot over the last week or so. I feel like your Chinese stuff, you avoid the R-rated language and you save that all for English. Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, my Chinese level of writing in you know, it's way more elementary. I mean, I use it more as like almost like a poetry way, where it's like really just it's like I'm missing a couple words in there maybe, but it still makes sense. You understand? Yeah, it, you know, like
I might use it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I like it that way.
I got the opposite problem. Is I always use the R-rated language accidentally, like in an academic conference or something like that. I'm also, you know, swear accidentally, because I learned it from a bunch of guys who swore like, you know, drill sergeants. So that's how I learned Mandarin.
Lovely. And with that Beijing?
Yeah,
with that
Beijing swear?
Oh man, that's knives. Yeah, that's daggers.
I read an interview once that you distinguished between Chinese rappers and Chinese people doing rap.
Yeah.
What's the difference? What's that distinction and why is it important to you?
No, I think it's the idea of Chinese hip hop and Chinese rappers.
Okay.
That there's no such thing to me, in my opinion, as Chinese hip hop. Just because you're Chinese or just because you're rapping in Chinese or just because your music has Chinese elements doesn't make it Chinese hip hop. Just like if a black person is doing martial art, doesn't make it black Shaolin martial arts. We're just participating in each other's culture, you know, like, but you could be a Chinese rap. You could be a Chinese rapper, you know, like, the, so because I think about this because, again, like, you know, when I first started incorporating Chinese language and instruments, I was like, how do I make you know what I mean? I was like, yo, I'm about to make some real Chinese hip hop, you know? Like, I remember doing a band camp interview. I even tell them to call it Oriental Trap or something, you know? Like, I was like, I was really trying to work, you know, like certain terms back then, you know, and get the music out there, you know? But, yeah, it's like this idea of a selling point. It becomes a selling point. I realized when I put Chinese in my raps, blogs want to write about me. But before I did that, they didn't want to write about me. So it became a selling point.
Yeah, but that
must
be kind of frustrating, though, because, I mean, it's like, you know, if J. Cole puts out a new song, the headline is not going to be like, black rapper puts out a new song, but will you put out a new song or a new album, it's going to be Chinese rapper or Asian rapper puts out a new song.
Great point.
Is that ever going to go away?
Or that's a great point. I think I used to be frustrated with that same thing. Like, yo, I'm a rapper. I'm an artist. That's it. You know what I mean? Don't call me, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I'll say the same thing. Like, yo, you don't, you know, see them labeling Kendrick, you know, black rapper. But, you know, I thought about it. I was like, yo, that's not going to change from their end until, it's like a time. I think I honestly believe it's a time thing. Until this becomes normalized, until there's enough dope Asian artists out there that's putting up quality content where we don't have to bitch about like, oh, what represent us. Well, you have anybody that's putting out dope content, you know what I mean, that can compete with Kendrick and everybody, you know, like, so I feel like until then, you know, maybe in a really perverted way, labeling me a Chinese rapper might help someone click on that and listen to my music, you know, like, so that's kind of where I'm at with that right now.
Yeah. I feel conflicted about this too, if I can butt in here.
Oh, absolutely.
Because, you know, when Bohan and I first started working together, the way that we would get press was for me to go and target all the Asian American writers and put like the identity narrative at the forefront of every single pitch. And that was the only way that we would get coverage ever. So it was like, do we, you know, pull out the stops to exoticize ourselves and like, you know, brand Bohan Phoenix as a Chinese American rapper, or do we just not get press at all? Right. It really felt like this kind of messed up double-edged sword in a way, which then, you know, when talking about identity and Crazy Rich Asians and Fresh Off the Boat and just more media representation did come around, people were like, man, all you guys talk about is your identity. And so it was, you know, it was a difficult position to be in. But I think in many ways, at the same time, I'm grateful for the writers who wrote about us that way. And because it really did help us connect with a lot of people in the community who, like me, not too long ago, were looking for Asian American rappers and wanted to find them. So
yeah,
it's tough.
Well, I apologize for being another one of those.
We are used to it, my friend.
All right. I kind of apologize again for the next topic, which I have to segue into, which is, you know, really very much about identity. But it's about, you know, this time historically where we're seeing just this increasingly hostile relationship between China and the United States, which I'm sure is causing you guys to need therapy as much as I do right now. I mean, it's just really f***ing me up in such a bad way. Allison, I know you've lamented the whole adversarial framing in so much of the media. That was years ago, though, before it even got as bad as it is.
Yeah.
And I think we all realize it's just going to get worse in the coming months, maybe even in the coming years. But are you guys as artists, are you going to need to choose between markets? I mean, I think we all recognize there's an urgency to build something that connects the two, right? We want to keep that connection going, but we also have to eat. And you know, is there in that space between a viable market, or are we going to have to decide it's the U.S. or China?
So, you know, up until now, we have this idea that we can do both. We're going to have a foot in either side, you know. One, because we got in China pretty early and we know a lot of people that are doing the shows, doing the festivals. I have personal contacts with all the venues and all the cities, and I'm friends with pretty much all the artists out there, you know, and we have really great relationships out there. So, you know, that we pictured that will work out there. And over here, which, you know, I would love to win a Grammy for whatever it's worth. It's like some sort of validation from the system. You know, I know, to people that's silly, but I would love to win a Grammy over here. But I mean, you know, with the recent issues and me actually being an American citizen, I can't even go back to China.
Right.
So, and even before this, the last 2 years, I mean, Allison has wrote extensively on this topic about Chinese government, especially the Art Performance Bureau, not granting licenses to foreign acts. Like, yeah. I myself gotten many festivals canceled the last year before coronavirus. So, I mean, I would love to choose both, but I think, hopefully not, you know, it's going to choose for me at some point, you know?
Yeah. That sucks, man. Mm-hmm. I mean,
just a little more, just in terms of content wise, I think my music is actually more understood in the West than in China, which is my style and my music. And also the fact that it's mostly in English, you know, but
yeah,
in China, the my fans, the fans that I have in China, they really just are the best fans. They fuck with me so hard.
You know? Oh, nice.
They hold
nice,
it down. Nice. Yeah.
So, I mean, we're all pretty pissed off about this whole rise of anti-Asian racism, the xenophobia that we've seen in the U.S., especially, you know, after the advent of COVID-19. But, you know, there are also lots of allegations of xenophobia aimed at white people, even in the Chengdu hip-hop scene. You know, Shitty had that song called Guala Wai. I don't know if you remember that.
Yes, of course. Man, that's a hot topic right there.
Yeah.
I mean, so, Kaza, you lived in China, right?
Let me ask I did.
You this. When you were in China, Did you see two different type of foreigners, like behavior wise?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I know where you're going with this, and right. Yeah, I do.
So, they
can't always tell. They can't always tell the difference,
right?
You know?
Exactly.
I mean, it's like you could say the same thing about, you know, anyone. You know, hey,
for sure. So I think you know, his point was just totally lost by a lot of people, but you know, the way he was making the point though wasn't the best way neither. You know, like, I think what he was trying to say was on a lot of Chinese people who are living in China's minds, you know, that there are a lot of foreigners that come here and they're very respectful of how things are, how people live in China. And, you know, they want to be part of the community instead of being like, I'm an outsider. I'm from a richer GPA place, you know, and I'm going to, you know, come here and be an asshole about it, you know. And he was talking about those people that were being an asshole about it. But unless you're living in China, you don't know
sure.
that.
No, I know. We've all encountered those people. I mean, the guys who go.
Right. And he was big enough that, and then he had this video. I mean, he has this video of this mannequin, a white mannequin. He has a baseball bat to the face, right, to the head. You know, like, no matter what you talked about in the song before that, you ended the video with that, and that's all people see, yeah, you know? So I think his message was good, but the delivery was just totally wrong, you know?
So you guys have both spoken out quite a bit on Twitter, Bohan on Instagram, against the surge in anti, you know, Asian hate speech and the violent attacks that have come from us.
Yeah.
Let's talk about what you guys have, you know, what's your reaction been to this, and what you think maybe Asian American artists should be doing to kind of mobilize people and to raise awareness of this.
I mean, the thing that makes my reaction is that I don't want the Asian community to get so mad over this that we end up doing and saying things that make us look just as stupid. You know, like.
You're talking about those dudes who are saying, like, I got guns, you know, if you hit me on 911 and I'm going to...
Yeah, it's like shut the fuck up, crackers. Like, I'm going to come and find out where you live. You know, just doing the same, really, like, just internet warriors, keyboard warriors, you know, like, and I think instead of, like, getting so, you know, I'm mad, too. I'm super mad, too. But, like, I don't think attacking people who are already so ignorant is going to make you feel better or make them change their minds. You know, I think at this time, more than anything, it's enforced the fact that, we got to love each other. We got to support each other. The only reason we are here on earth is to help each other, you know, like, and this is no better time than to enforce that belief, you know, and that's a personal belief, you know, but, and, you know, I actually was talking to Allison about this. I was like, yo, how am I, like, just, do I just got a big mouth? Like, how come I'm the only one kind of, like, talking about this? Me and China Mac, you know, like, you know, like, China Mac is out here talking a lot. But, you know, and I was like, what, is it, like, a fear of losing followers? Is it, like, a fear of, I'm going to look like I'm just, you know.
Another guy fixated with identity or, yeah.
Yeah, you know, like, and I was like, and, you know, we thought maybe it's a little bit of everything, you know, but, and maybe, you know what, maybe if I had a million followers, I wouldn't do that. Who knows? Like, maybe it's the fact that I only have 10,000 followers, 12,000 followers, and I'm like, you know what, I have nothing to lose. Let me speak my mind on this, you know, like.
You'll have more after this.
Hell yeah, baby.
Allison, I want to ask you a specific question about one response to this, and that was from Andrew Yang. I can't say Yang. I somehow just can't make myself say.
I feel the same way, man.
I know, right? I know what you mean.
I see him, you know, Yang Gang, and I always go, oh, that's Yang Gang.
That's Yang Gang. Why does that sound? That sounds like a character from Shui Hu Zhuan.
Yeah, Yang Gang, exactly. Anyway, he wrote this Washington Post op-ed in April. It had, you know, it sparked a lot of backlash from the Asian American community, including me. I wrote very angrily about this.
You should wear American flags.
Exactly, exactly. Wrap yourself in the flag. You know, do your part. As you know, it's like loyalty tests all over again. Right. How did you guys react to that?
I mean, I had a very similar reaction to you too. It just it I don't. And it was really hard for me to articulate it, especially as like a second generation American who owes so much of who they are and the privileges that I've had in my life to Americanness. And, you know, let me tell you, moving to China definitely like checks you in your privilege and your Americanness, right?
Oh, for sure.
but something about the way it was phrased was just so off-putting to me. I kind of felt like the way that it was spun was such that like, it felt like a setback in this whole Asian American narrative where it's like, oh, so I gotta choose? Like, I can only be like this crazy flag wearing freak, or like, it just, I don't know. It made me very uncomfortable, to be honest.
Right. Like me, what everything I've done so far is not American enough. And that's why that's happening to me. You know, it's like, you know, that I haven't been wearing an American flag. That's why the shit's been happening to me. That's why someone pointed at me and called me Ebola on the subway. Oh, because I don't have an American flag on. You know, it's like, I mean.
Yeah, that's what it is, man. You see an American flag. Thanks, bandana. Andrew.
I mean, up until then, I was riding with dude. Again, I'm not a big politic guy at all. You know, like. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, and then it made me just question, like, wow, like, maybe I, you know, shouldn't speak up on anything at all about Andrew Yang.
I was pretty disappointed by him, but and I never really saw him address it again later either, which is maybe he did. Maybe I'm being unfair, but I should look and see whether he did. But yeah, the whole Yanggang response was that.
Hey, did you see Jin's song Yanggang? The Yanggang song?
No, man, I haven't seen that.
So when Obama was running for president, he had made a song shouting out Obama. And then he made it, Obama got a picture. And so he did this song about Yanggang over Wu-Tang B.
I'll check that out. For sure. Wu-Tang really is the first Chinese rap.
they really are.
It's so funny because, you know, my band was called Tang Dynasty, and anytime people would be like Wu-Tang Dynasty or whatever. Like,
hell yeah. Wait, did you say that they're the first Chinese rapper? Because you read that I said that somewhere, or you just said that?
I just said that. I didn't ever read you. You said the same thing. That's pretty funny.
Hell yeah. I was actually a couple Asian girls at Oberlin, Ohio. They had invited me to go do a show at their like Chinese Student Association. And they're like, can we have a panel talk beforehand on culture? I was like, sure. Like, and it was just all Asian people. And it was like, oh, okay. I guess we're going to have a culture, talk about culture with all Asian people, you know, Chinese people. And then like the first question or second question was like, so how do you deal with the fact that you're Chinese and you're rapping?
What?
I was like, how do I deal with the fact? You know, like, oh,
I have
man.
Thoughts about this.
I don't know how
I really
I got
do.
Here.
Yeah.
I forgot how
that's
here,
a, that's a whack question. It's a terrible,
that's
terrible,
a whack question.
Yeah. Terrible question.
I mean, I feel like I actually thought about this a lot after Trump got elected. Because I remember when it happened, it felt like a slap in the face and a shock to me, because I realized that like my entire, you know, news consumption habits, my social media chatter was just this giant echo chamber of algorithms pushing to me things that I already wanted to see and already agreed with. Mm. Like if we want to talk about preaching to the choir, like that's kind of what that felt like, right?
Yeah.
And you know, I think that like while that has like there's a beautiful thing about that sort of like algorithmic recommendation of things that you already care about, and that it's, you know, you can build community that way, you can connect with like-minded people. That's fucking awesome. But I think it also, you know, in a way that I hadn't really anticipated, put up blinders for me, that like where I wasn't seeing other narratives anymore, and mm-hmm. you know, they became sort of invisible to me. And so I think, you know, to answer your earlier question about sort of how the Asian American narrative has changed and what Asian Americans should be doing, is I think right now is a time and sort of a unique time where we're all kind of like at the mercy of the same COVID-19 situation. And it's such a time that like we should really be realizing all the things that we have in common as a human race rather than separate races within, you know, the planet and whatnot, and come together on things. Because I mean, we can talk about our own problems to our own communities forever, but it takes the cooperation of others outside in order for change to actually happen for any of us.
It'd be nice to see that happening. I mean, I feel like, you know, the Asian American community is not the ones who are experiencing a massive failure of empathy and, you know, recognition of our common humanity right now. It's being like inflicted on us Hey, you guys, I got to be respectful of your time here.
Wait, Kaza, can I ask you a question?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so, you know, have you ever thought, I've always wondered about this, and I don't know how to conclusively think about this topic. Do you ever think about, like, being Chinese or being Asian or being non?
So the weird thing about me is that I was in China for 20 years, and I am really pretty new to the whole kind of experience of Asian Americanness in America. So it's a weird thing. And, you know, here I am, like, I'm in my early 50s and I've come back after 20 years, and it's like I'm learning the whole thing. And it's just such a different thing for me, because, you know, my wife is from Beijing. You know, my kids are super bicultural, but I grew up in the suburbs without any Chinese, you know, people around. I went to UC Berkeley and everything, but, you know, while I was there, my focus was, you know, so much on China and the United States, not on Chinese Americanness. So I'm a weird case in that. So my thing has always, I kind of have stubbornly insisted that I can identify as both, And yeah, people can't wrap their heads around that. And it becomes even more difficult in a time of extreme political polarization between not just, you know, the two parties here, but also between China and the United States. Nobody wants me to be able to say I am of both worlds. You got to, I mean, so that's a pain in the ass. So when I was in college, a lot of the Asian American students groups wanted to enlist me. You know, they thought, hey, this guy, he speaks well. He knows what he's talking about. He's Asian American. And I got really cynical about it. I found like that a lot of them purported to be representing, you know, recently arrived Cambodian, Laotian, Filipino immigrants, you know, people from pretty, you know, underprivileged backgrounds. But the people themselves who were in leadership positions in these organizations tended to be third generation, second or third generation Chinese, Japanese, or Korean Americans who, you know, whose parents were engineers, you know, and you know, they, here they were at UC Berkeley. They lived in, you know, 5,000 square foot houses. And I felt like it didn't ring authentic. It felt like this was a cobbled together identity for purposes of sort of your advancing your own political prospects. So I have a very different take now. I think there was a lot more to it, but that was my unsophisticated take on things back then. So I resisted it, and I'm relearning it now.
Sounds pretty sophisticated to me, to be honest. I mean, I think I think the whole Asian American culture idea from somebody that comes from the outside, usually, you know, non-Asian person, is this kind of like assumption of Asian Americans being monolithic and this sort of treatment that completely, completely overlooks like immigration and class and socioeconomic standing. And that's such a part of it. Like it's so diverse within the group itself.
Totally. And yet I've now understood one really basic thing, which is that no matter how diverse we know ourselves to be, they are going to treat us like a monolith. They are going to treat us the same. They're not going to stop and not throw that rock or hurl that epithet because they don't know whether you're Chinese and therefore a bearer of the virus, or Japanese or Korean. Or if you're Chinese, they're not going to know, you know, are you, you know, sympathetic to the Chinese Communist Party, or are you, you know, it's like, okay, so yeah, if you're going to treat us all as this category of Asian American, we've kind of got to own that and act accordingly. So that's where I am. You know what? We got to move on to recommendations. I actually have to hop on this thing in 15 minutes. I was in this documentary film, and I have to be on a panel post-screening. So Bohan Phoenix, Allison Toy, what an absolute pleasure to speak with you both. Yeah, man, I love your stuff. You guys are just doing some great stuff together, and I wish you the best of luck. Thank you for taking the time. Let's move on to recommendations. First, I want to really quickly remind listeners that the Seneca podcast is powered by SupChina. If you like this podcast and the other fine shows in our network, one way you can really help to keep us going is to subscribe to SupChina's Access newsletter. For just $88 a year, you get this excellent newsletter delivered to your inbox. You get early ad-free access to this podcast and discounted admission to our major conferences and free admission to our live podcast recordings should we ever be able to hold them again. Lots more. So sign up, show your support. On to recommendations. Allison, why don't you start us off? Give us something that you've been into recently.
Oh, yeah. This one's easy. Oh, you know, good. To speak of the non-monolithic Asian American experience, I got to shout out and recommend my guys from Asian Not Asian podcast.
Oh, yeah.
They're two incredible comedians living in New York City who have a great cast of guests, some Asian, some not Asian, believe it or not. And they've got a great little thing going there, always super entertaining. They get into some really deep topics, but they also have a lot of fun doing it. So big shouts to Fumi and Mike, who man up Asian Not Asian podcast. Check them out.
That was great. Yeah, no, those guys are funny. Definitely I endorse that one. Okay, man, Bohan, you are up. What do you got for us?
My recommendation would be Jay Chou's album called 8 Dimensions.
Oh, cool.
八度空间. That was 2001, I believe. 2001 or 2002. That was the album that I picked up while I was picking out cassettes for my Bubu Gao to learn English. Yeah.
Bubu Gao.
And so if I listen, Bubu Gao is like a very known, it's like the only brand for cassette players in China, you know, like, and the album cover was really cool. It had like him half bionic, half normal, And I just remember, you know, bringing it home and listening to it and never heard anything like that before. And he was actually the somebody, you know, that was doing something so ahead of his time in 2001 in China. So definitely recommend people check that out.
That's a great old school recommendation. Terrific one. I'm going to recommend an article I just listened to on Autumn last night. It's in the Atlantic. I love this app Autumn, AUDM, which, you know, they have like all the best stories from the New Yorker, from the Atlantic, from the New Republic, from all these. Anyway, I'm kind of addicted to listening to stuff like when I'm puttering around the house and doing dishes or baking bread or whatever. But this one was called "The Prophecies of Q." By Adrian LaFrance from this series that The Atlantic's done called Shadowlands. It's about conspiracy theories in America. And it's just so weird, man, what this QAnon stuff is really all about. I mean, it's just so warped and dangerous. And I feel like we really have to understand it because it's nuts. It's just, I was so mind blown by the fact that it's as big as it is and it's as complex and sophisticated as it is. Yeah, The Prophecies of Q in the Atlantic. So check that out. Yeah, the letter Q. You know, these like Trumpers who show up at rallies or they used to before COVID with the letter Q on them. Like, who is Q? You know, they have all these weird slogans. Okay, so that's my recommendation for the week. Thank you guys once more. I want to give a special shout out to William Yuan, who is our intern there in New York. He contributed mightily to this episode. So thanks a lot, William. Also to Showtime, to Dana Tiago Burton, who is the founder of the Iron Mike competition. He's been promoting hip hop in China for decades, and he's a really good guy. And I asked him about you, and he told me what a great guy you were. So, all right, guys. Thanks. You have a good night. All right. Thank you. Take care. The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn with editing help by Jason McRonald. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com, follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SubChina News, and make sure to check out all the other podcasts in the expanding Seneca Podcast Network. Watch this space for announcements of new network shows. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. Take care.